content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we are on the chapter Conception, which takes in January and February. And we left off last time with the speaking Latin. And I will continue there, for indeed, what's important is that you learn the words and let them help you to find the desired plant. As a bonus, certain botanical Latin words also reveal a plant's characteristics. This is particularly true among the species names, the second word in each binomial, which modifies the genus. What follows is a sampling, in most cases expressed with a dash US ending. Or a dash A and a dash UM are also used when the gender of the subject being modified is appropriate. And we start with color. Yellow may be expressed with flavus, a pale version, or luteus and citrinus, lemon-colored. Red is rubrum. Rosy pink is roseous. Purple is simple. Just say purpurous. If it's very dark, it might be atropurpureus. White is albus. Black is nigrum. Silver is expressed as argenteus. Gold is aureus. Green, when it's noted, might be viridis or sempervirens in the case of evergreen. Shades of blue include azureus and a sky blue color, and ceruleus is somewhat darker. And I'm just going through these. These are for when you're looking at catalogs or in the shops or the garden centers. They may have these names, and this would give you a little bit of an inclination as to what that plant, the color or the habitat or the texture or anything is. So we'll go now with growth habit. If a plant is graceful or slender, it might be designated gracilis. The globe-shaped globosus might be more appropriate. A pyramid, more pyramidalis. A shrubby plant might be labeled fructicosus or fruticus. Frutescence. Upright and columnar. Look for the word festigiatus or columnarus, downright narrow with nearly parallel sides is linaris. A dwarf plant might be nanus or pumilus, a creeping one repens or flat on the ground prostratus or procumbens. If it spreads in a straggly manner, divaricutus is a possibility. If instead the plant climbs, it could be called scandens. Now, the surface texture or pattern, pleated leaves might be indicated by the word plicatus. Woolly ones are often labeled lanatus. Mollis means soft because the plant is covered with soft hairs. Glaucus, as in some blue-leafed hostas, means glaucus. coated in what's called bloom, a fine, waxy, powdery coating. If the surface glistens, it could be called fulgens. If it's spiny, spinosis. In a more appropriate epitaph, variegated leaves or flowers are sometimes labeled variegatus, but might also be called pictus, which means painted, and is used to indicate bright coloration of other kinds too. Spots might be indicated by the word punctatus. And for the fragrance, look for inodorous, means a plant has no fragrance. Aromaticus and fragans mean that it does, but so do pungent, odoratus, sweet-smelling, and fœtidus, fetid or stinking. Bloom times. Some epithets, such as praecox, mean simply early. Seasonal interest in spring is expressed by vernalis, summer by estivalis, fall by autumnalis, and winter by hymalis. Habitat of origin. Plants from wet places are often called pelatris or aquatis if they actually live in water. Those from rocky areas may bear the specific epithet of saxatilis. If sand was in their background, arenarius is the word. Woodland denizens may be sylvaticus or sylvestris. Those from above the tree line are alpinus. And hybrid, heirloom, or both. What I have realized in recent years is that hybrid or heirloom isn't an either-or debate, but rather a false construct, as if one could not ethically elect to grow both, as I do. I long thought I was not a hybrid person, but an open-pollinated, OP type, and I often vote this way with my seed shopping dollars for sentimental reasons, and as a nod to helping preserve the plant's genetic imprint into the future. I also like to save seed from some varieties and OPs, whether 50-plus-year-old non-hybrids, referred to as heirlooms, or newer modern OPs, which may become the heirlooms of tomorrow, will come true to type if grown properly. Sometimes isolation distances must be observed. Hybrid seed doesn't. You need to order more or be okay with an unpredictable next generation. But none of that makes hybrids bad. Gregor Mendel made hybrids. Nature has done it herself by moving pollen around. Hybrids have saved me in more than one tough season when I have been growing a hybrid bred for particular disease resistance, something some heirlooms may not have. If you have ever had an outbreak of early blight in the tomato patch, a fungal infection that can cause the plants to lose leaves from the bottom up, or verticillium wilt, which can occur in a cold, wet season with susceptible varieties, you will understand. Speaking of tomatoes, my two musts, the cherry tomato, called Sun Gold, and highly disease-resistant Juliet, which produces grape-like clusters of 2 1/4-inch fruit that I make sauce from, are both hybrids, growing alongside various heirloom beauties. I like to read all the fine print when seed shopping, because sometimes in either OPs or hybrids, it's some unexpected quality that breeders or other seed stewards of that variety have made possible, a quality I didn't know I was looking for. By guiding the genetics of open pollinated varieties through selection, favoring certain naturally occurring traits over others, a bean that's easier to locate and pick amid all those leaves has been created, such as purple potted blue cocoa, a pole type and pre-1775 French heirloom, or Bush Royal Burgundy. Cucumbers, too, can be elusive under lush foliage, but OP H-19 Little Leaf has what its name implies, the most visible cukes. Plus, it sets fruit without pollination and can be left under a row cover all season if cucumber beetles are an issue. Through active hybridizing work, classical breeding like Mendel did by providing a human hand in cross-pollination, not laboratory-style gene splicing, that creates transgenic hybrids or GMOs. Traits from different parents are married. A hybridizer might aim to create a cucumber resistant to a range of diseases, or a broccoli that heads up and can all be harvested at once, the kind of uniformity that farmers in particular rely on. While I may like a broccoli that produces a little bit at a time over many weeks, like Pyrocycaba, it would be unmanageable to harvest an acre of it repeatedly for market. Look beyond the photos and even beyond the labels of merely OP or hybrid, often listed as FI or F1, and see all of what other variety has to offer. And our next topic is seed viability versus vigor. The seed catalogs are here, and I'm getting organized. Step one, taking inventory of what's on hand. But how many of the seeds I have left over are still not just viable, but also have sufficient vigor to perform well, start to finish? That's the sort of advanced question I'm asking after a little episode with a packet of leftover collard seeds that I was feeling glad to have on hand, a feeling that quickly changed to dismay a couple of weeks into their sorry time outdoors. When taking inventory, first, I refer to the general guidelines for how long seeds last, summarized generally in a chart, and I'll read some of that from the chart. I do a germination test of any packets older than a year, assuming there are enough seeds left. Being low-tech old school, I simply line up 10 seeds on a double thickness of moist paper towel, fold it over, and put it in a sealed plastic bag in a warm spot in my house. I check inside the bag starting after 2 or 3 days, which, taking note of how many seeds sprout after how many days, hoping to see perhaps that 8 or more have done so and in a timely manner, and also basically in unison with their siblings, not staggered days and days apart. Temperature and type of seed affects how long a good result will take. Carrots or parsley make you wait longer than a radish or a bean. The collards in question, which were in their third year with me, sailed right through. Virtually all germinated concurrently. But when the other seeds from that same packet were direct sown in the garden, things were different. They came up, yes, but then just stood there like miniatures, never developing. Germination tests predict viability, the ability to germinate, but cannot accurately predict vigor, the seed's potential for uniform, fast germination and subsequent development into real outdoor conditions. Life in the field isn't the same as life in a piece of moist paper toweling indoors or in the germination chamber of a seed company lab. As viability declines, damage to the seed, a reduction in its vigor, accumulates gradually until eventually the seed dies, like my unfortunate collards were on their way to doing. If I'd had a second packet of fresher collard seeds on hand and tested it at the same time as the three-year-old ones, I might have seen some differences, emphasis on might, since I am not a trained plant physiologist. Perhaps the roots of the older seeds would have been less developed, even stubby or non-existent, or the cotyledon, the first leaves, might have been in some way visibly deformed, with one missing, or overall the tiny plants on the paper towel might have looked more crooked or scrawnier than those from the fresher lot. There's no home test for vigor, though several kinds are used in agriculture, where the critical subject is the focus of continuing fine-tuning. But knowing a little more than I did about vigor when I failed with those deceptively high germinating collards serves several purposes for me, and that's why I mention it. It makes me think about storing leftover seeds more carefully and about replacing seed more frequently, not pushing it. Also, small comfort, but something at least, it makes me realize that collard failure wasn't something I did wrong in the planting or aftercare. Try as they might, those seeds just didn't have it in them to go all the way. I'm now clear on this lesson. Just because seed germinates doesn't mean that it will thrive. Remember, the viability chart assumes that you're storing properly dried seed in optimal cool, dry conditions, and that it's seed that developed on its parent plant under optimal conditions in the first place, including good conditions close to harvest time when wet heat and humidity can diminish its eventual staying power. And it has a chart here of how long seeds last, but we won't go through all of that. You can look at the seed catalog or the seed package may also say how long it will last. Normally, just it has here, use it between 2 and 3 years, but after that, they may not be useful. And our next topic is first sowing, onions and leeks. It is too early for tomatoes, but not for leeks and onions. My official first indoor seeding of each new growing season, each such crop needing an indoor head start in my northern location, will grow under lights in flats or small pots, requiring regular watering and perhaps occasional feeding to develop from seed into a garden-ready seedling. Though parsley takes about the same number of weeks indoors before transplant, 8 or 10, it doesn't go outdoors as early as leeks and onions do, 4 weeks before final frost compared to parsley's 1. The way the math works, counting from my last frost date around mid-May, means those two edible alliums lead off my lineup with mid-February sowings and will make their way outdoors sometimes in the second half of April. When to sow and transplant each crop relative to their frost date is presented in a chart in the birth section of this book, and when we get to that, I will read some of it, and that is in March and April. And keep in mind, in North Carolina, the first frost is around the April 17th, so the end of frost is April 17th. So this book may have it going a little bit, well, actually a little later, because she's in the north. But when they bear 10 weeks, gardeners think growing onions and leeks from seed is hard, and I did too for decades. Besides the investment of time, the seed is relatively small, and I was impatient and maybe clumsy in one early attempt at wrangling it into individual cells in a seedling tray. Forget this, I thought. As is commonplace, early each spring I bought seedlings by the bundle of about 50 at like $15 to $20, costly compared to a packet of a couple or several hundred organic seeds that can be had for under $5, though still a great deal compared to buying organic onions at the grocery. As with any crop, buying plants also limits variety choice. I haven't bought bundles of transplants since I got a tutorial from Don Tipping of Siskiyou Seeds at Southern Oregon, a longtime organic onion grower and breeder, among other specialties. The time it takes hasn't changed. In Don's greenhouse, it's about 8 weeks for onions and 10 weeks for leeks, and in my shed under lights, about 10 to 12. But everything else did. He sows into open flats of potting soil, 10 by 20 inch shallow wooden boxes built for the purpose. But I use plastic seedling trays minus the usual individual cells. Be sure the trays have drainage holes or create some. His homemade seedling mix is 8 parts compost to 1 part sand, plus some eggshells and a little kelp powder. I use an organic brand of germination mix. Using a finger or pencil, make little lengthwise rows in that tray. Sow in those tiny furrows, but not too thickly, aiming for 8 to 10 seeds per inch. In Don's flats, he gets 4 or 5 rows, and the seedlings can reach about the size of a pencil. At transplant time, Don employs another onion growing trick, one he credits to Elliot Coleman of Maine, who has long provided inspiration for organic farmers and gardeners. If spaced in the typical manner, gridded out with about 8 inches between each plant in all directions, as well-grown onion can, a well-grown onion can reach 1 pound or even 2, especially sweet onions. Who needs a 2-pound onion? Save transplant time and guess recipe size onions instead by scooping up clusters of 2 or 3 seedlings at a time from the flat, planting them in the same hole with holes a foot apart. Submerge the point where the seedlings change from white at the bottom by the roots to green, so that there is an inch of soil above where the root starts. As they're growing, they'll push each other apart. The wider spacing also leaves more room for weeding. And the next topic is saying no to deer. During a garden workshop, a visitor commented on how he looked around at the mature shrubs and big swaths of perennials. "You must have a fence, because otherwise this garden wouldn't be here," he said, "because it's mostly hidden in the surrounding woodland tree line." He hadn't spied the fence itself yet, but he just knew. It's a deer-free zone. "I'm a serious gardener, and my home is in serious deer country, adjacent to a 5,000-acre state park where groups of 4 or 5 animals browse my boundaries daily. And in winter, I have seen 40 at a time just across the road. I had no choice but to fence, but in some circumstances, there are other tactics, from temporary or smaller barriers, than my 2.3 acres of 8-foot fence wire mesh encloses to repellent or limited a choice of when you plant." And we will continue that topic on saying no to deer next time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service and our program, Out in the Garden, which you can listen to every week. And again, we'll start with saying no to deer.